Look up idiot in the dictionary. You know what you'll find?
A picture of me?
No! The definition of the word idiot, which you fucking are!
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to I Do Movies Badly, a podcast exploration of my cinematic ignorance. I am your host, Jim Rohner, and despite being an amateur film critic since 2006, I am woefully ignorant of many films, filmmakers and genres that consensus has deemed important, and thus I have created this podcast to document my journey into cinematic edification. This month, I'm exploring some films from Kim Ki-duk, as recommended by David Bax, and this week's episode, I'll be talking about his 2003 film, Spring, Summer, Fall, Winter, ...and Spring. If you are listening to this podcast on the East Coast, then hopefully you are taking some time away from work in the heart of this snowpocalypse. Maybe travel was too dangerous for you. Maybe the public transportation shut down. Your job or your local government told you not to go outside unless it's absolutely necessary. So you were sitting at home, hopefully in some form of sweatpants or shirt with maybe a mug of hot chocolate or coffee next to you, and you are enjoying yourself on this lovely snow day. Hearing about South Korean cinema. If you're listening to this podcast on the West Coast, specifically in Los Angeles, snow pertains to frozen crystalline water throughout its life cycle, starting when it precipitates from clouds and accumulates on surfaces, then metamorphoses in place and ultimately melts, slides, or sublimates away. But enough with the weather report. Why don't we get into talking about Kim Ki-duk. I'm sorry, I didn't intend to let out that heavy sigh. I feel like I'm batting 0-for-2 here. I don't know. Once again, I'm making an episode on a film that didn't really strike me strongly one way or another. It's another sort of almost sort of passive movie-going experience for me. And as I said in the last episode, I find those to be the most infuriating when I'm watching them, because when something doesn't stand out to me right away in the sense that I think this is excellent, or I think this is terrible, or I'm responding strongly to that this way, or I'm responding strongly to that way, I find that to be frustrating, because then what I sort of have to do is homework, in a way, in the sense of kind of doing a bit more research on a film, digging a little bit more, and I'm trying to kind of, in a way, I'm sort of relying on other people's opinions and what other people have said about something, more so than my own reactions to it, my own experiences, to judge, not the value of a film, but to sort of judge perhaps what it might trying to be, or what it might try, what, why am I getting my language mixed up here? What it might be trying to say, as opposed to what it is actually speaking to me. And when it doesn't really speak to me very strongly, as The Isle didn't, despite the fact that I still got like a 46-minute episode out of it, when something like that happens, I sort of, I have to rely more on reviews and what is sort of the background of this film and this filmmaker. I have to dig a little bit more into context. I don't like doing that because I have a podcast here which is all about, or mostly about, my individual, Jim Rohner's individual subjective response to a piece of art. How does that piece of art's creation speak to me and my creation, and you know, vice versa? And when that doesn't happen, I have to rely more on the context. In The Isle, I talked a little bit about how, okay, well, David kind of laid out this background and this context, and so let me be very deliberate in looking back on that and looking back on these notes and kind of thinking like, okay, how does this point line up to what I just saw on screen, or how does this sequence sort of, you know, inform this point that David said? And I don't like doing that because then I'm sort of, like I said, I'm relying more on what's been told to me more so than my experience with this movie. And that happened again with this movie. I'm just going to refer to it as Spring Summer because I don't want to continuously go through all the syllables in pronouncing the full title, because since it is quite frigid outside, it is once again rather tropical in my apartment. So the more syllables that I speak, the sweatier I'm going to get. And nobody wants me to be sweaty, especially me. But that happened again with Spring Summer in the sense of I was... Look, with every movie that I do on this podcast, I wait to be blown away by it, or I wait for it to sort of open some type of door for me that is going to change something within me. And I guess with this one, with Spring Summer kind of being his Kim Ki-duk's most well-known film, the one that is that if you had heard of this filmmaker, you probably heard of it because of this movie. This movie was on Roger Ebert's great movie list, you know, so knowing that there was a bit more prestige or notoriety behind it, was thinking that maybe this would be easier, or there'd be something about it which is a bit more universal, as opposed to The Isle, which seemed like it was little seen, little distributed, and a little bit more esoteric. Not esoteric, I actually think, of those two, this one is the more esoteric one. This is certainly the more esoteric one. But I guess, I don't know, I just thought there'd be something about this one which, like, okay, well, there's a reason that this one is the more well-known one. There's a reason that this one reached a bigger audience. There's a reason that this one appeared on Roger Ebert's great movie list. And then I sat through Spring, Summer, and at the end of its, you know, whatever it is, 1 hour and 46 minute runtime, I still wasn't any clearer in the sense of what I'm supposed to be getting out of this. What is it about this movie which got it on the great movies list? What is it about this movie that David Bax told me, this is a movie you need to see and this is a filmmaker you need to see? And I don't know what the need is there. But knowing that I have this podcast in which I'm assuming you are listening to this, trying to get my, because you are somewhat interested in what my opinion on this movie and movies might be, I have to make an episode of it, and I have to have thoughts generated from it. I have to speak to you in an honest manner. And I don't like when I have when I don't have a strong opinion on something, because then what I have to do is sort of let other people's opinions sort of be the guide for me, in the sense of if I'm not responding strongly to something, then I have to say, okay, what did this person say? Do I agree with it or not? Okay, I don't agree with it, so I'm going in an opposite direction. Then I don't agree with that thought, so I have to go in an opposite direction with these thoughts. And then I kind of have to rely on these outside perspectives and opinions or outside context to kind of steer me in a direction. Think of it sort of like, in a way, almost like bumpers on a pinball game. You know, no, don't go that way, don't go that way. And it's kind of pointing me in something, or it's pointing me in the direction of something almost sort of forcefully, because I'm not getting there on my own. And I don't like that, because my opinions aren't as strong. There's a bit of ambiguity and question in the sense of, like, do I actually believe this? Because the film didn't speak to me in that regard. But nevertheless, here I am kind of trying to take some points from things that I've heard in the past, or things that I've read, or things that have been told to me, and kind of thinking, like, okay, in that context, maybe this is what this film is not even trying to do, because that implies that Kim Ki-duk did it one way, and this is what it's supposed to be, and this is how you're supposed to interpret it. But at least kind of thinking, like, okay, give me a context, and then let me see how this film sort of fits into it, which I don't like, because it's sort of like, instead of taking a picture and finding a frame for it, I have a frame now and I'm trying to see how I can jam the picture in there, and I don't like that. It becomes not dishonest film criticism to me, but it becomes uncertain, because as I said in The Isle, I'm not sure if this stuff is inherent in the movie, but I'm trying to correlate whatever I saw with I'm trying to take a context and kind of use it to correlate what I saw into some sense of meaning. So basically, I'm uncertain, just like it was with The Isle. I'm uncertain if anything that I'm going to say now is what I'm supposed to be taking from this movie. But I had to make this a worthwhile, enjoyable viewing experience for me, because I'm making a podcast episode out of it, and I'm being exposed to new ideas, to a new piece of art that I would not otherwise seek out. So I'm trying to make sense of that experience. So here we go. First and foremost, it deserves saying that Kim Ki-duk, jacked, clearly a man who takes care of himself. If you are not aware, then the monk at the end of this movie, the one who takes in the child of the woman who has covered her face, the one who is doing a whole lot of martial arts work, who's doing push-ups, who's doing kicks, who is in quite peak physical form, that is director, writer and director Kim Ki-duk, actually. So good on him. That guy's doing something right, because I certainly don't have abs or arms or legs that look like that. That is obviously the most important takeaway from this movie, is Kim Ki-duk's physical stature and workout regime. But aside from that, there's other things that I try to take away from the movie. And what I tried to do was, instead of sort of relying on the the context or of the background of Kim Ki-duk's religion, the religion that that is predominant in his country or anything like that. Because honestly, I didn't remember a whole lot of that, because that was the further away from the introductory episode, the less I remember the finer points that were talked about that. Instead, what I the context that I used to kind of make sense of Spring Summer was actually the Isle. And I think at first I couldn't avoid that because of aesthetic reasons. For instance, how many at least visual similarities Spring Summer has with the Isle. And they are all superficial things, but that was the first connection that my brain made. And then once my brain made that connection, that was sort of the context or the lens through which I was viewing this movie. And I found that to actually be a somewhat interesting viewing experience because of how those two films don't even compare with each other, but how they sort of juxtapose each other. And I think, like I said, those superficial observations, first and foremost, it starts out, it is some form of isolated, let's say, community that is living in a lake, which seems to be far away from the rest of modern civilization. There is a proprietor of this community who sort of takes care of its well-being. At the Isle, that woman was in a different, let's say, psychological and emotional state than the proprietor of the community in this one, which is that old monk who seems to be very well collected and also somewhat supernatural. And of course, most prominently, and I guess importantly, would be that both of these films also raise questions about what we, as humankind, deserve in the context of our relationships to the world around us. That certainly played out negatively, tragically, in the Isle in regards to how the man and the woman treated each other. And sort of that idea that I think the movie sort of ended on, the implication that they were sort of caught in this spiral of bringing each other down, or at least in the sense of they were not working on helping each other, but they sort of, you know, as two damaged people were furthering the damage within each other's lives. And that idea of any bad thing that it was sort of this cycle, you know, one, he does a bad thing to her, she does a bad thing to him, in return there's this cycle of well, this is sort of what they deserve as these two bad people who are just feeding into it with each other. And that is different, of course, from Spring Summer, but there is still this question of what do we deserve in the context of our relationship to the world around us, because in Spring, when you have this young little monk who is, you know, he starts out adorable and innocently enough, but then you see him sort of, let's call a spade here, sort of torturing these animals, this, you know, this fish, this frog, this snake. He does it with a kind of laugh. There's sort of a somewhat of an innocence, but it's sort of a cruel innocence, because he doesn't, I get the impression he doesn't really fully understand what he's doing, which is why he's doing it, but, you know, he ties rocks to them and then kind of lets them go and sees how these animals struggle and toil and suffer through it. That is cruel. And so we start out with this idea of like, oh, here's this cute little monk who's going to grow up to become a wise, enlightened monk, just like this old guy that looks over him. And then you see this kid do this and like, well, you little shit, you know, these things are innocent and defenseless, and you have sort of an obligation to take care of them, or at least at the very least to not abuse them. And that's what he does. And there is a, you know, it's natural to sort of have a reaction. Not that you think you want the kid to die or anything like that, or at least I hope you don't want the child to die just based on this, but you do kind of get the sense of like, well, this little shit isn't an innocent kid. Something has to happen to him. And of course, if it does happen to him, the old man makes him carry a rock around. Ha, taste of your own medicine. But it also just, it kind of throws us a little bit for a loop, or it defies our expectations a little bit, sort of like it did with the cop character, or the you know, our protagonist, who is the cop who is escaping in the front. So we kind of assume he's a good person until he tries to kill himself, until there's the rape attempt, until there's just all this terrible shit that happens, and you kind of see like, oh no, this guy is corrupted in the core of his being, and that is going to poison everything that's around him. This little child is not corrupt, but I think it is interesting that this film kind of introduces the idea of where that corruption that was in that grown-up man. Where did that start? Where did that come from? Is it something which was inherent inside of him, or is that something which was introduced and he never took care of it and that just was allowed to fester? The film doesn't ask those questions, but that's the questions that I found myself asking. How did this guy get to that point? Was it something about human nature, or is it something where it's just without direction and guidance, that's the path this guy headed down? And so there's this little kid who is doing these cruel things, but who eventually kind of learns his lesson. You kind of do get the sense, or at least I got the sense of, well, this is going to work out okay for him, because unlike this other guy who maybe didn't have guidance, this kid does. This kid has this wise old man who has lived enough, who has prayed enough, who has meditated enough, who has experience enough where he can guide this kid back into the right path. But the old man also had this quote, which it didn't really occur to me until today when I started thinking about it, you know, a day after I watched the movie, where after he ties the rock to this kid and as a punishment, he tells him to go and find the animals and untie all the rocks from him. And he says to this little kid, if one of them has died, you will always carry this stone in your heart. And it was today that I started thinking, like, stone in the heart, this little kid, one of those creatures did die. The fish he did find the fish dead. He found the snake dead. He was able to free the frog, but the other two animals were both dead. And I wondered, when it came to that, when it came to the stone in his heart, was that act, or these acts of, not necessarily doing that to the animals, but doing that and then an inability to redeem himself or to save them from his acts, is that, or was that a stone in his heart that was planted there and that was not able to come out, which then eventually festered and led to a point where he falls in love with a girl, leaves this little monastery to pursue things with her, becomes overcome with lust and jealousy to a point where he murders the woman and then flees, comes back to the monastery, and is eventually captured by police. Was that stone in his heart planted all the way back when he was this little kid who did this cruel thing to these innocent animals that never did anything to him? And was he unable then to get past that? And that somehow led him on the path that would ultimately lead him to murder, which I say it out loud, and it sounds unfair and it sounds cruel that, like, what? So this one little thing that this kid did when he was a young, stupid kid has irrevocable effects that affected him for the rest of his natural life. That really doesn't seem fair. But it's just a question. I don't have an answer to it, but I just kind of thought back on that and wondered, like, oh, what was this? Was that foreshadowing? Did that actually, you know, rather than it just kind of be something which is separate unto itself, those actions of him behaving that way with nature, behaving that way with forms of life that he has a superior or a power over, that he was supposed to take care of and didn't, did that actually set the tone for the rest of the film, at least for this kid? Did that kind of key us into, like, this is what this kid's life is going to be like? I don't know. I'm not saying that makes sense to me or that I agree with it. It was a question that just occurred to me today. But getting back to this idea of juxtaposing these two films together, what I actually found myself doing as the film was going along was kind of putting both of these films in the same physical universe, to the extent of I sort of imagine, and the film seems to contradict this, based on the one shot at the end of the film when the monk is on top of the mountain and he sees his monastery in the lake where he just came from, crawled up a mountain with this rock around his waist. But I started thinking, like, wouldn't it be interesting if these lakes were, like, right next door to each other? Like, you have this lake with this floating monastery on which you sort of have this seasonal change and this symbolic story of sort of life and development, evolution, and then death and resurrection, and sort of the cycle of things that repeats. Wouldn't it be interesting if you know, just a few hundred yards away from this lake was that other lake where there were these little floating houses where these terrible people were coming to kind of escape from their problems, to fish, to fuck prostitutes, to do whatever, to get away from whatever civilization had for them. That he was sort of these two neighboring camps. One was sort of like, you know, one was one side of the coin, the other one was the other side of the coin. You know, I don't want to go so far as to say heaven and hell, but just two different life experiences, two different communities or areas in which the people living there were trying to, not even trying to, but were taking their life into their own hands in vastly different ways. Or at least the actions of their life or the consequences of life were dealing with them in two very different ways. And I kind of thought we're with the Isle and with our protagonist there, you know, where there's what leads him to this lake community, it's sort of escape. So where there's escape in the Isle, there's an overcoming in spring, summer, or at least this idea where this is a place to come where you can work through and where you can overcome what is dealing with you, whether that be a spiritual thing, such as the Buddhist monks, such as them, you know, this idea once again of, let me flip back to the page of the basic beliefs and practices of Buddhism, but this idea of there being a path of the cessation of suffering, you know, the Eightfold Path, where there is that reality and existence that exists for the monks. There is also the physical healing of this young woman who was introduced into the area. So there's escape in one lake, and there's overcoming or working at it in another lake, where there is turmoil, where there is grief, where there is suffering, there's peace in this one. And then where there is lust in one and jealousy, there is more of a curiosity in the other lake. And I developed that thought probably about halfway through the movie, around summertime, when this young monk who's grown up into, I don't know, let's say a monk who's in his 20s, meets this girl, and he's very curious about her. You know, he is clearly very attracted to her, but he doesn't seem to know how to act around her. And I thought there was an innocence and a curiosity to him and to this idea of a female being introduced into his otherwise chaste existence. But then, of course, he leaves the monastery. Desire becomes lust, which becomes jealousy, which becomes murder. And so, but I also think that it's interesting is that those things, this desire turning into lust, turning into jealousy, turning into murder, all occurs after he leaves the lake, after he sort of enters the outside world, which once again brought up a question to me that I don't have an answer to and also seems a little bit unfair, but this idea of the implication that this lake here, this little community, this floating monastery, this isolation, this is the way to live life. This is the way that you should be interacting with the world. This is a symbol of perfection, and everything outside of this is bad. And there's nothing explicit in the text of this movie which would say that, but it is the implication or what I pulled from it in the sense of this old man who we have to assume has lived at this monastery for probably his entire life. And I say that because if there is symbology, symbolism, I'm sorry, the Amazon, I know it's a proper word, but the Amazon explanation of this movie used the term symbology, and whenever I hear symbology, I think of that dumbass detective from the Boondock Saints, and I hate anything that reminds me of that movie, but symbology and how they made fun of him for that because the actual word is symbolism, is even though symbology is a real word, it doesn't sound like it should be a real word. But if we look at the symbolism of this movie as a cycle of like birth, living, evolution, death, and resurrection, then the fact that this movie begins with a relationship of a young child and this elderly man, and then sort of ends with a young child being brought into this community or into this, I have to assume that the old man, when we see him, his life had to start in the same way of a young child that was brought here, was raised in the life, achieved enlightenment, and then was trying to pass it along to someone else. But if we accept that this old man has lived here his entire life, then this is clearly the way, right, that you are supposed to live your life, because he has achieved peace. He has achieved enlightenment. He has achieved supernatural powers. And there is a sort of a perfection in from this community. I don't say that in a pejorative or judgmental sense. I mean, it is a wonderful place. It is really seems like to be heaven on earth to a certain extent. I mean, I was watching this movie and I kind of like, I wanted to be there. I wanted to visit there. I wanted to meet this man and to sleep on this monastery. And I wanted to swim in the water and I wanted to walk in the woods around it. And it was a real sense of peace and like, I want to be there. And I didn't have that with the Iowa. It was sort of like, get me far away from these people, get me far away from this place. This is an unhealthy place to be. And I did not feel that at all with watching this little community in spring and summer, which I will touch on a little bit later. But so if there is this idea of like, this is perfect, this is how life should be, and once you leave here, that's when shit goes bad for you. That's when things are going to be bad. Because it's also, if you want to sort of track the, for lack of a better term, descent of this younger monk character, sort of starts when this woman comes from the outside world, when this young, sick girl comes here to kind of be cured, to kind of, it's not made clear what her affliction is, but there is something physically ailing her, and she comes here to be healed, and that is sort of the beginning of the end for this guy, because he falls in love, and he experiences what lust and desire, and then ultimately jealousy and murder is like. And I don't want to blame it on her, but it does seem to be that there's this element of this outside influence coming into this community and then changing things irrevocably. And then it's when the ultimate act of murder, or it's that ultimate act of sort of imbalance in murder comes into play, is when he leaves, is when this young monk leaves his community and goes into the outside world. And so I wasn't sure if the... the message behind that, or reading between the lines, was sort of like, this monastic living, this perfect balance with nature, with the world around you, with peace, if this is the way that you are supposed to be living, this is the way that it is supposed to be, and everything outside of this is not, you know, this is natural, everything outside is unnatural. Which, as a city dweller, I have big problems with, because I live here clearly because I, well, not clearly, but I live here because I love living here, because I love living in the heart of people and where there is diversity and culture and where there is a need. As a Christian, there is here a need for me to be an example and to act out my faith and to serve other people. And so if this film is saying, like, hey, this is how it should be, I have real qualms with that idea. But these, once again, this is just a question. I'm not sure if the film is raising that question or if that's just a knee-jerk reaction that I had as a Brooklynite in 2017 watching this South Korean film from 2003 set in an entirely diverse culture than the one that I am experiencing it. There is, of course, a motif of water, which was something which I found very interesting in the Isle, in the sense of how water in relationship to with the world that was around them was sort of like, I phrased it in such a way where it was sort of like, not that the nature was a character in the Isle, but it was sort of like nature was unchanging, was there. The trees were there, the water was there. They could have hurt you, they could have killed you, they could have been relaxing, they could have been anything, but they were just there, they were the constant. And it was sort of this idea of nature kind of existing on the periphery and almost kind of saying, like, look at all the fucked up shit that is going on here. Look at how these humans hate and abuse and hurt each other, and we are just here, just being, you know? I can't say that that's the same for spring and summer, because we are clearly going through cycles there. But there is a something natural, and of course it's natural because the seasons change. That's what happens, unless you live in Los Angeles, which, what I understand, doesn't have seasons. But there is just like spring, summer, fall, winter. Dot, dot, dot. And spring is just that implication of, like, this is how things are supposed to be. We start out with budding flowers to sweltering conditions to what is death? I mean, fall is death. It is the trees. It is the foliage. It is dying. It is death. It is this idea of death, and then cold and frozenness and just this bleakness, which ultimately brings way or gives way once again to a rebirth, to a refresh, a new start with the budding flowers, which then again goes through this whole cycle. And there is this this sense of, not that nature is unchanging in this, but there is something which is changing, and that is so natural. There is something so, in a weird way, relaxing about this cycle of death and resurrection, because that is sort of a constant. That is something which is reassuring that, I don't know, for me, I kind of saw it as a thing of, like, this too shall pass, but also in the sense of something that is consistent, something that can be counted on to occur, is occurring. And that's sort of something what I appreciate. And certainly it was, I don't know. I don't know where else I'm going with that thought, but that's just something that occurred to me once again. There is something which is relaxing and comforting about this cycle, which is going through, because it's, I mean, I guess tying it into this idea of Buddhism and enlightenment and reincarnation. And once again, if I have any Buddhist listeners out there, I'm sorry. I don't know if reincarnation is a major tenet of Buddhism. But certainly the description of this movie that I read on Amazon had something about, you know, Kim Ki-duk using symbolism of the season as a kind of tell a story about, like I said, birth, death, and resurrection. But there is something that's comforting about kind of seeing something at start, because at the start of this movie it is incredibly beautiful because it's spring, the flowers are blooming, the sun is bright, and just like and everything just seems so incredibly peaceful and wonderful. And like I said, I wanted to be there, I wanted to be in that environment. And then you eventually get to this point where, yes, fall is beautiful, but once again, it is fall is death, is the leaves falling off, you know, and brown and dried and dead falling to the ground, and then which is followed by winter, in which it seems like nothing can ever be good and happy again. For most people, I happen to love winter, sitting here waiting for a snow apocalypse to occur, and I could not be more excited about it. But it just is an idea of nothing grows, nothing is new, nothing is fresh. There's just things are frozen and locked and still. And then the fact that spring comes again and these buds bloom and that we go through the whole cycle again is like this idea that there is hope, in change, that there is hope in this constant cycle of things that are happening, which should one have a belief in resurrection, there is that same hope, that idea of that death is not the end, that things can repeat, that these people can come back again in a different form, but they are back again. Their spirit has returned, especially if you are one who has achieved enlightenment and has done good things, then there is going to be goodness returned to you in resurrection, in reincarnation. And of course, I mean, that's not just a Buddhist thing, but that is a Christian Catholic thing as well. That idea of, like, death is not the end for us, that there is death, but there is also a resurrection of some kind in Jesus Christ. There, and this just idea of that there is no end, that there is something more that comes after this thing that we're experiencing, whether you want to call it life or whether you want to call it a season, whether you want to call it an era, anything. But this idea that there is not a firm beginning and end to anything, but that there is something beyond those things, which is something which is beautiful and quite reassuring and quite comforting, and is accented by sort of the very Zen camera work that Kim Ki-duk has in this movie, in which, like again, I can't point to any one shot in particular, but there were just so many where I was sitting there and thinking to myself, like, it would be really lovely to be there right now. It would be so wonderful to be just rowing around that lake or swimming or just running around the dock with that dog or just walking through the trees. Like, it was just Kim Ki-duk just kind of shows you things and kind of lets the natural beauty of not just even the, not just the aesthetic beauty of the place kind of take over you, but also there is, and I don't know how to describe it, but there is just a way that he shoots these certain things, these scenes, and the people interacting within their environment that just kind of hints or implies, like, this is the way things should be. And there's a peace and a comfort there, and I kind of really loved that. I don't know how to describe it. I can't point to something in particular and say, like, oh, there was this shot in particular, but it's just, there was just a real piece to the things that he was shooting. I guess here's a good example, in the sense that the sex scenes didn't really seem out of place or unnatural. And I think that's because, I stole this quote from Roger Ebert, in his great movies, entry, but, Ebert says that the way that Kim Ki-duk uses sex and violence, he says that the nudity and sexuality is context, not subject. And I think he's right, where in the sense of, like, certainly the first sex scene between these two characters, I did not expect it, but it wasn't voyeuristic, it wasn't glorified, it was part of it. And he even shoots it in sort of a, not a super long shot, but it's kind of far away. They're just on a little shore, and they're just having sex, and it's not... Like I said, it's not sort of like in your face and kind of like, look at these two fucking. It's just kind of like, look at them there, lying on the shore, enjoying each other in this environment. Like, it's part of the environment. It doesn't fetishize it. I think that's the word I'm looking for. There's nothing sensational about it. There's nothing where it's like, ooh, this is shocking. And it was the same with the violence in the aisle. It just sort of was part of that environment. It just sort of was part of that story. And I think that speaks volumes to Kim Ki-duk, that it's like, hey, here's a sex scene, but it's not out of place here. It's not out of place in this zen, very beautiful environment. This just is part of the story that's being told, of the world that's being created. It is, as Ebert said, it is context, not subject. It is just part of this world. And I love that. I love that it wasn't sensationalized. That there was something that was truly beautiful about it. And it wasn't the act itself, which was the sin, but from what I gathered and understood, but it was the deceit behind it, and also this idea that the man, the young monk, wasn't partaking in it for the right reasons, and that what he was pursuing was not the right emotions. And so it wasn't necessarily the woman that was corrupting him, it wasn't his desire that was corrupting him, it was the reason that he was pursuing it, or I guess what he chose to grab onto, I guess. I don't know. That, now that I said it, that doesn't make any sense at all. I don't know what I'm saying. I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say about these movies. As you can see, I hope that this wasn't a waste of your time, or that you can at least kind of see, like, I'm not sure what I'm trying to get out of this. I'm trying to kind of, like, find a framework to derive my thoughts, or to derive thoughts, and I'm not sure if I'm doing it very well. There are some things that I'm certainly responding to, but nothing where I'm like, oh my god, I can't, like, this, I gotta talk about this on the podcast, or ooh, this is an interesting thought, like, I gotta write, like, it's just, I feel like I'm forcing it, and I don't like that, because I want these episodes to come naturally, and I want my thoughts to come naturally. When they don't, it's a much harder episode to make, and this is the challenge that I have with Kim Ki-duk so far, that I'm really hoping, it lightens up a little bit on the next episode, because I don't know if I could do one more of these. Not in the sense of, like, there's nothing unbearable about these movies. These are not terrible movies by any stretch of the imagination, but just, like, what am I supposed to be getting out of this? And the fact that I'm trying to, like, wring thoughts out of it, I'm trying to squeeze blood from a stone to a certain extent, it's really kind of frustrating, to be completely honest with you. I'm trying to, feels like I'm trying to force it, and then it's not a natural and or entirely honest episode. And so I don't like doing that to you, the listener. I don't like delivering something which is half-assed or dishonest. I want these episodes to be me, and I want to engage with you on them. But when I'm not even sure what I think, it's much harder to deliver me. Spring, summer, winter, fall, ellipses, and spring. I'm sorry, spring, summer, fall, winter. Did I say that? I don't know. I can't, my brain. But spring, summer, fall, winter, ellipses, and spring is super accessible, unlike the aisle where there's pretty much only one place you can get it. Amazon for rental and purchase, Google Play for rental and purchase, Vudu for rental and purchase, Fandango Now for rental and purchase, which is a service I have never used, but it's certainly out there for you, and also iTunes, but only for a purchase. One thing I forgot to mention on the aisle episode was that while it is available through Amazon, the quality of the actual video stream itself is not super great. Was quite grainy, and I thought it was like kind of a buffering issue, but since it was in perpetuity, it was not. Spring, summer, fall, winter, and spring, you are not going to get that. It is a completely clear, a wonderful picture. I believe shot digitally, at least that was something that I was kind of was distracting at first, or at least I was noticing, was like, hey, this has a very digital look about it, in the sense of this looks like it should kind of be a TV movie. But considering it was 2003 and it was shot in the middle of, well, seemingly nowhere, it sort of makes sense that a filmmaker would opt to shoot digitally rather than on film stock. Let me just take a look at the full specs here. Of course, this is the most interesting aspect of it. Yes, and I'm correct. Oh, no, this is Pieta. I'm sorry. I was looking at the technical specs for the next title, which is going to be Pieta, of course. Spring, summer, winter, fall. Ellipses and spring was, let's see here. Oh no. Well, inconclusive, I'll say, in regards to, but it does have a very digital look about it, in the sense of like, you'll notice if you've seen it or if you watch it again, it does really seem like it has a kind of a TV, look to it. But that is not a distracting thing. That is, just something that I noticed because I work in video production, so I am a nerd when it comes to that kind of stuff. But it is super easy to get in touch with me, and oh my god, please, someone besides David, not that I hate you, David, even though I just wrote you that email that said I think I hate you, but someone besides David, please chime in, let me know your thoughts, whether it's in the comment field, whether it's on email, whether it's on the Facebook page. I want to hear from other people. When I don't have a strong opinion one way or another, I want to hear from people, because I want to know, what did you get out of it? How were experiences different? How did you respond to this piece of art that I didn't respond to? YouDoMoviesBadly@gmail.com is my email address. The Facebook page is, of course, I Do Movies Badly. I am Nolan Fixateeth on Twitter, or you can just go to BattleshipRetention.com. In the drop-down menu for podcasts, go to I Do Movies Badly, where you can leave comments on the past episodes, or you can do the same thing, leave me a rating and comments on the iTunes store as well. That about does it for spring, summer, fall, winter, and spring. I apologize for the rambly and unsubstantive nature of this episode. This is the challenge I have in front of me, where I'm kind of come out of this movie with these viewing experiences with nothing and have to make an episode out of it, and I'm finding it increasingly difficult. So hopefully that doesn't happen on the next episode, in which I'll be wrapping up Kim Ki-duk and wrapping up the month of March. With his 2000 film, or 2012 film, I should say, Pieta. So be sure to tune in for that, and hopefully I will be just a little bit less ignorant and have a little bit more things of substance to say.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.